You said their feet should be covered,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So what is the ruling on a woman wearing, for example, a special type of socks? Like, for example, thin pattern, colorful socks?
It is, according to scholars, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, forbidden for a woman to show her adornments, you know. And the adornments is not something, you know, one applies like in like lotion, like for example, mascara or something like that. It can be in the form of socks. Now, it is forbidden for a woman to show her adornments whatsoever to non-mahram. It's haram to let a non-mahram, you know, see a woman's you know, adornments. And it can come in, the adornments can be in the form of clothes, it can be in the form of socks, and if the socks are, you know, attractive, they are catching the attention of the men outside the woman's family, then she must not wear them, or she must cover them with something.
Mm-hmm, I see. A very quick question, Sheikh. You know, some girls wear newly designed or stylish dresses, right?
Yeah.
And in light of this, they go out wearing a abaya and a veil, wearing these stylish clothes only in a family setting or situation or in front of their friends, even though these designs are often worn by unveiled women. So what's the religious law about varying them?
Well, it is obligatory for a woman, according to what Allah Almighty says and what the Messenger of Allah has said, and also the infallible Imams have commanded, to cover all parts of the body. Mm-hmm. It's for a woman, I'm speaking about a woman covering, yes, her body, you know. So it is necessary for a woman to cover her head, to cover her hair, except her face and hands from the sight of men. Of course, this is something we repeatedly are saying it. And as for how to cover up, this is the question. It is up to the woman herself, you know, to choose how to cover herself. But it is necessary that the dress she wears is not see-through, it's not transparent, and it should not reveal her attractive parts, okay? Her attractive parts. That the cloth must be loose, it should not be,
tight.
You know, tight or close-fitting, and therefore it should not be, the dress she wears must not lure men, you know, and cause men to be sexually aroused somehow, and that's the point. Everyone understands, you know. Every woman knows that whether the clothes she wears is of this nature or not. Does it attract men or women, or it doesn't? So if it does, she must not wear it.
Mm-hmm. So,
yes.
In plain terms, she don't have to actually look hot.
Yeah, of course. Let me say it in just one sentence: the clothes she wears must not be see through.
Yeah,
it must not be tight. It should not be revealing,
mm-hmm.
and it should be loose.
Yes,
and it should not show the attractive parts of her body.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha states, "Start doing good deeds at the moment, since all of them are being recorded, and the doors of the mercy of Allah are always open." This means that every person is welcome to enter to the spiritual realm. Now, there are some obstacles and hardships in our lives. These difficulties make us closer to Allah, because we understand that the only way to reach to happiness is through worshipping Him. Now, in the past, there were some tight lanes in the cities of Iran which were called friendship lane. If two persons or neighbors had a fight or quarrel, they could talk over it in this lane. These lanes were so tight that the people couldn't pass each other without taking a look at each other. Now, the tightness of the alley is very much like the difficult situations we are in. Whenever we find an obstacle on our way, we want to reconcile Allah. The main reason is because it is only through Allah that we can solve our problems. Thank you. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Kalam Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Olema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Kalam Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
It's always a tricky task to remember people's names at a party, but not in this particular gathering in Tokyo, where all the guests had the exact same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. 178 Hirokazu Tanakas came together on Saturday to set a new namesake gathering world record. Their ages spanned from 3 years old to 80. The Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people with the same first and last name previously belonged to Martha Stewart. 164 people with that name came together in New York in 2005. In the Tanaka's gathering, every man was assigned an alias inspired by their hobbies, occupation, or favorite foods to tell them apart from others. One nicknamed by his birthplace says, "It's strange to meet so many people with the same name." Obviously.
It's a strange feeling to know that there are nearly 200 people with the same name. To be honest, I'd presume there are more popular names out there like Suzuki and Sato. This achievement is really because of the efforts of our organizer.
The man who organized this gathering is a 53-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka who has worked for years to make this happen. He says his quest began in 1994 when he stumbled upon news about a baseball prodigy with the same name. After that, he began tirelessly scouring the nation for his namesakes. He then founded the Hirokazu Tanaka campaign that brought the men together and created a strange friendship among them. Thousands of baby turtles have been released into Peru's Amazon basin in an attempt to preserve the rainforest ecosystem. More than 6,000 hatchlings of three endangered species of turtles have been released into lakes and lagoons in Peru to help them repopulate. To make this happen, wildlife officials collected the eggs from their natural habitat and transferred them to artificial beaches until they hatched. The river turtles are considered vulnerable because for many years they have been killed for human consumption or kept as pets. Scientists are currently trying to conserve the Amazon to avoid catastrophic climate change, and Peru has the second largest share of the rainforest after Brazil. Another world record news. This time it has been set in Switzerland. A Swiss railway company has run the world's longest passenger train with a trip on one of the most spectacular tracks through the Alps. To celebrate its 175th anniversary, Switzerland's rail industry launched the world's longest ever passenger train, measuring around 2 kilometers. The electric train took almost an hour to cover around 25 kilometers over the UNESCO World Heritage Albula line in eastern Switzerland. The Albula Kula line is famous for its endless swooping curves and steep descents. Rail enthusiasts lined the valley to watch the train's 100 cars snake through the Alps. Belgium and the Netherlands were the previous record holders for the world's longest passenger train. They used standard railway through the flat landscapes.
If you enjoy street art, then you'll probably like Iztapalapa district in Mexico's capital city. Nearly 300 neighborhoods in this area are beautifully painted with brightly colored murals for all to enjoy. Visitors can also ride a cable car and take a tour of the art from above. The district is home to nearly 7,000 murals and graffiti painted on all sorts of surfaces, including rooftops. Iztapalapa Murals is a project that was promoted by the Mexico City's mayor in 2018. The goal of the project was to recover and dignify public spaces through art and involve neighbors in its creation and conservation. Iztapalapa is one of the poorest municipalities in the capital, and the initiative aims to reduce neighborhood violence through public lighting of the murals during the night.
It is never too late to learn a new skill. That's what 100-year-old Nada Rudan has shown with her art when she discovered her love for painting at the age of 87. The Bosnian native says she started to paint to keep herself busy, and now she finds the days are often too short to fit in everything she wanted to do. The artist paints for 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon without glasses. Rudan marked her 100th birthday with an exhibition of all the works that she has painted over the years.
My 100th birthday, I've celebrated it at sea. That was really a big event for me. Before that, I had an exhibition that I didn't hope for. But my children persuaded me. I was against it. I'm not an artist. I said, children, don't embarrass me.
She says she's inspired by nature and her travel around the globe. Rudan has lived in numerous areas such as Central America, Hawaii Islands, Europe, and the Asian Himalayas, among many other places. The artist survived both World War II and the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Iran's Kish Island is known as the paradise of the Persian Gulf. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been to the stunning southern Iranian resort island and has filed this report about its beautiful attractions.
It's snowland at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. This snow town is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists, while U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai. The island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
A 78-year-old artist is making a comeback with a unique art installation on Governor's Island in the United States of America. One of its biggest features is the sound and creaking of moving chains.
It's a project that I proposed for a commission in St. Louis. The site of the commission was the area near the Mississippi River and the St. Louis courthouse. So I wanted to do a piece that addressed those areas and the subjects. And of course we have those areas in the Mississippi River, which is a place that you talk about the history of American commerce, but also we can talk about the history of slavery.
Charles Gaines wanted to highlight the role slavery played in building the economy of the United States. That's why he purposely used chains, and the sculptor pointedly faces the Statue of Liberty in New York City. The installation is roughly 30 meters long and activated by colossal chains that rotate on anchors. The installation is part of a three-chapter series called The American Manifest, Moving Chains. It will be kept for all to see until the summer of next year.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out three patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC.
If you have a sweet tooth, then this next bit of news is just for you. Visitors are now taking advantage of the expanded version of Cakeland, which is an immersive art gallery in the U.S. city of Los Angeles. The structure is meant to feel like a giant multi-layered cake. It's entirely made of artificial materials, but looks like if it's full of cherries, whipped cream and layers of cake. Artist Scott Hoff says he used nearly a ton of pipe frosting, 120 mirrors, and thousands of cherries. Plus, he embedded thousands of crystals in the walls as a final touch. The artist says he chose to develop Cakeland after he noticed how much his artificial cake sculptures were welcomed by viewers.
So I chose cake because, number one, it's really beautiful. Number two, it's really fun to do. And number three, it engages the viewers in such a meaningful way.
Hoff says he never actually made a real cake before and has mainly followed his enthusiasm for fake food as the inspiration for this project. Visitors are able to walk through the cake, a labyrinth, and explore various rooms. While there is a lot of deliciousness and lightness of the cakes, visitors to this cake land can discover some interesting darker elements as they wander around. The art installation has continued to expand since it was founded by Hov in 2020. Robots are slowly but surely becoming part of everyday life, taking on human roles in different areas. Now, fast food restaurants can make French fries faster and better as a robot called Flippy 2 takes over the job.
When an order comes in through the restaurant system, it automatically spits out the instructions to Flippy. It takes a frozen product, fries it for the precise amount of time, and puts the finished product in the end. It does it faster, more accurately, more reliably, and happier than most humans do it.
Flippy 2 has been created in a robotic lab in California called MISO after 5 years of efforts by its developers. According to the project engineers, a really good understanding of the food science is needed to make sure the food quality is there, how different food sticks together, and how the temperature and heat affect it. The MISO CEO says the machine can cook several meals with different recipes simultaneously, removing the need for catering staff.
This technology utilizes a whole bunch of computer vision. There's cameras throughout the system, including right here we have these food identification cameras. The cameras not only guide the robot and tell it exactly where it is in space and how to move through this area, but also identifies the food type, and it knows the recipe for each one.
The MISO CEO says tasks like the fry station are the kind that humans are most happy to offload. The name Flippy comes from the original machine designed to flip burgers, which was not very useful for restaurants.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhide kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Zainya. Sheikh Zainya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaykum to you.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Sayyid Muhammad Musavi Shirazi, mainly known as Sultan al-Wa'izin Shirazi, the author of the outstanding work Shabhay Peshawar or the Peshawar Nights, which is also translated into English language. Okay, let's be more familiar with Sayyid Muhammad Musavi Shirazi or Sultan al-Wa'izin, Sheikh Ziyaniya, from your talk.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Musavi Shirazi, namely known as Sultan al-Wa'izin, was born in 1314 according to lunar calendar after Hijrah in the city of Tehran. And his father also was known as Ashraf al-Wa'izin, one of the best of lecturers. We should know that his genealogy goes back to 25 mediums goes back to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wasalam, the seventh Imam of Shia school of thought. He started his elementary Islamic studies in Pomenar in Tehran, a very famous Islamic seminary in Tehran. And then in 1326, he moved from Tehran to Karbala, and there he got benefit from Sheikh Ali Shahristani and Ghulam Hussein Marandi. And then he moved to Qom. And yes, in Qom, because he was in higher level, he got benefit from Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri, rahmatullah alayhi, the founder of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
That's all right.
We should know that Sultan al-Wa'izin is famous because of his preaching trips to different countries, mainly to India, Egypt, Jordan, and Palestine.
Yes.
And one of these, you know, preaching gatherings is very famous and is well known to all people.
Yes.
That is also written and, you know, compiled in a book named as Peshawar Nights or Shabhai Peshawar.
Shabhai Peshawar. That's right. Okay. What is the story behind this? This we can say series of dialogues of Sultan of Wa'izin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother mentioned, Sultan al-Wa'izin was regarded as one of the great speakers of his time. And during 1345,
yes,
the month of Rajab, he was invited to Peshawar, one of the cities in Pakistan. So this is very important to know. During those years, he was almost 30 years old.
Okay.
So almost very young. So even if you wanted to compare to our youth in the same age, you have to consider, because the significance of the book right now we are facing, it's really rare to have such a youth in the same age producing such a book. So as I said, he was invited to Peshawar in 1345. In the last 10 days of Rajabul Murajab, to be delivering some speeches for the crowd over there, among which mostly they were Sunnis and also there were some Shias over there. So he delivered his speeches picking the very important issues or topics regarding Shia and Sunnis, and he really benefited from the Sunni sources. When you look at the bibliography of the book, references that he had benefited in order to produce his speech or his lessons, you see that he has benefited from the great books like Sahih al-Sittah, Musnad Ahmad ibn Hanbal, and the other books that we have from the Sunni authors. That's why we see how significant and important these speeches are. Why? Because when you are speaking to the Sunni crowd, you have to take advantage of their books if you want to talk, because they may not authenticate your sources as a Shia preacher. So that's why we see how his speech was really beneficial for them. Why? Because he was benefiting from the Sunni sources while he
it shows his mastery over the concept of different
Specifically
references
at that age, when he was almost 30 years old. Yeah.
That's all
and
right.
Among this book also, we have another work called Sat Maqale Sultani, 100 Essays.
Yes.
Or Sultani here is the kind of title for
title
that.
Given to,
yes, that is also very beneficial and important book. Why? Because it's a kind of comparative study on the religions of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. He had done a kind of comparative study over all detailed points being picked in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and trying to get the same as what he had done for the Sunni speeches. He's trying to get his sources from the Christian sources when it comes to Christianity, and trying to benefit from the Jewish sources when it comes to Judaism, in order to present a kind of comparative study to the readers to find out about the veracity or authenticity of Islam yes. compared to the other religions, which are Christianity and Judaism.
Okay, that's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
I myself produced a program on Call of Islam Radio called To My Brother. And the because there was a radio drama called Shabhai Peshawar, we can say on Ma'arif Radio. So I have translated the content of that radio drama, which is a radio drama. You know, there are some people in a session. One of them is Sultan of Wazin. The other ones are the scholars from a Sunni brother, and there is a dialogue between them on a specific topic. So I have translated them into English and then changed it into the radio drama in English language. Dear listeners can refer to the archive section of Call of Islam page on parstoday.com. Okay? It is a true defense of the Shia Islam, Sheikh Ziyaina, isn't it, this way? I mean, Peshawar Nights.
First of all, we should know that argument is something that basically we are not encouraged to do it. But when it is, you know, inevitable and the situation goes in a way that you have to do this argumentation, then Islam says that وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنَ. You have to follow the best way in argumentation. And yes, Sultan al-Wazid did his best to follow the rules in argumentation, and he was, alhamdulillah, successful in this way. So that whenever he is discussing about the school of thought of Ahlul Sunnah, he is not disrespecting anyone.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
He is completely respectful to the scholars there, to the figures that he is mentioning. He is not cursing upon anyone, but he tries to defend his belief in a way that he wants to say that, listen to me, I have my reasoning, and I break your reasoning also, and I break your argumentation. So this book is completely a scholarly way of discussion and tries to break the ideas that are, you know, sometimes stuck in these minds of some people in a very, very logic way and through their own words. This is very important. Sometimes you break others' words with your own, you know, argumentation, but sometimes you bring the brick of his word through his beliefs and his, you know, texts.
Okay.
This is the thing that is done in this book, and that's why this book is very important. We should know that very few parts of this book are the quotations from Shia resources. Mainly these riwayat and these stories and, you know, quotations are from Sunni resources.
Of course, in the first editions, because it was dialogue-based, there was no reference. But in the next revisions and the editions of the books, the references were also added.
Yes.
You know, and so many other, we can say, compilations based on this book were done. That's right. In the winter of 1400, according to the solar calendar, a conference was held also in the city of Qom. And the message of Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani was given. And also a software based on his books and biography, mainly known as The Defender of Velaya, written by Muhammad Ali Kermanshahi, was inaugurated in that session.
That's all right.
Okay, anything missed about him?
Okay, in continuation of what I was saying regarding the gatherings in which he was delivering, actually, among the gathering, there were some Sunni scholars that we might say that there was a kind of debates between them as well, because in some of the nights and gatherings, Sultan al-Wazin would deliver part of the speech, and they would come with their responses in the following nights. And as we say, as we have in the historical records, that on the six nights, some of those Sunni scholars among the crowd, they even converted to Shiism. Oh. They accepted the truth based on their understanding. Good. Because he had started from the first night, starting from the descendants of Lady Fatima and their priority over others to succeed the Prophet. And the atrocity being done by the Bani Umayyah against the descendants of Bibi Fatima, salamullah alayha, as we have in Karbala, and everybody is aware of. The second night, he talks about the real meaning of Shia, the title of Shia, when this title had been generated, and the history behind it, and even how Iranian accepted Shiism in this territory. In the third night, he is talking about different sub-branches of Shiism, because we have Zaydiya, Kaysaniya, and also we have Shia Imamiya, who is known as Ithna Ashariya, or Twelvers.
Okay.
So he's talking about these different categories, because these information, some of which might be misleading for the listeners, because someone may claim that I am a Shia, but he is not sticking to the 12 branch of the Shiism, other parts of the Shiism, and they may practice differently. And then he's talking about the concept of Imama, which is playing a very significant role in Shia theology, and talking about the Ahadith, which talks about Amir al-Mu'mineen and make the resemblance of Amir al-Mu'mineen with the Harun, the brother of Prophet Musa, and then the ahadith which were fabricated through the years after the demise of the Prophet.
Yes.
And in on the sixth night, on which I said that some of the scholars in that gathering thought of conversion, he was talking about the merits of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And in the following nights, the rest of the topics that were discussed in the following nights,
And his answers, which were really authentic and according to the Sunni brethren, you know, made a shining point of history on the, we can say, the history of the Shia Islam, the Peshawar nights, which is more than 400 times. It's been republished in Iran and around the world. It has also been translated into English language, and they, we can say, it's really outstanding.
And the number of the pages is one in one of the publication, you may say it's above 1,059 pages.
Yes.
In different publication might have different numbers, but the average amount of the book could be classified in kind of 1,000 pages.
That's all right. Okay. 1391, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, is the year that Sultan of Wazin Shirazi passed away in Tehran. His body was taken into Abu Hussein Cemetery in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried over there. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya.
You're most welcome.
For your presence in the program, the teacher talking about Sultan of Wazin Shirazi and his magnum opus, Peshawar Nights. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Thank you for joining us in a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. You're listening to us from IRB English Radio. Here with me, I have the pleasure to have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita. I would like you two to introduce yourself to our audience. Sister Bita, shall you please?
Yes, of course. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to you, my dear sisters and dear listeners. Actually, I'm really honored to have the pleasure to be here in this discussion and this episode of today. And actually, I'm Bita, a medical student at your service, and I wish I can just share my beliefs and my thoughts about our topic today with you, dear listeners.
Thank you very much, Sister.
You're welcome.
Now, Sister Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi
wa
barakatuh. Dear listeners, dear sisters present in the studio with me. It's really a pleasure to be here today and participate in this discussion. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language.
Thank you very much for
being here.
Let me ask you a personal question, both of you. During the time you were teenagers, or even younger than this, did you have any discussion with your parents? And don't tell me no, please.
Of course, I won't tell you no, because that would be a complete lie, absolute lie. You know, but even at this time, I still have many discussions with my parents.
So true, and, yes, yeah. It happens, even after you get older.
Because we are different generations, and different generations have different thoughts, and you cannot deny that.
Of course. Bita, I would say even those who do not have so much of age gap between the parents and the children, also they would have some debates over some certain issues.
I'm from the group that, you know, doesn't have that much age gap between my parents and myself. And I still have some arguing with them. But the thing is, I want to tell you that I'm from the youth generation. And I want to tell you that my generation is not always true. It's not always, you know, that much good to be believed, you know. We have to be balanced here.
Okay. I just like you and like most of people used to have.
Many others out there.
Yes, disagreements with my parents. However, the way you treat them, the way you deal with those discussions.
So this is the
is
difference.
What matters, yes.
Yeah. How the two of those sides are going to react to each other is actually the center of our discussion for today.
Yes, which is of crucial importance.
Yeah. Do you think that parents have the right to judge their children?
The older generation are older, actually. They feel like, okay, we have to have the control over this young generation because they are so young to, I don't know, to decide to do something. And
do you think it's really the idea that they like to control it?
Yeah,
or is
it
more of a thing that, okay, because when I put myself in their place, I would say, if I have a child, then I would put it this way. I know it better because I have been in their place. So it's a kind of been there, done that story. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's a matter of experience.
Yeah, that's a matter of experience.
I know it is experience or something, but the feeling which I get as a youth generation here from this older generation is like, okay, we're going to go and control you because you don't know nothing actually. And we don't want to experience this because we know that there is no, for example, actually result in that. Way, but I don't want it actually. Sometimes I think the youth generation have the right to experience, you know, even if it means that it costs a lot. No, it doesn't matter. You
so
have to experience.
Really, do you believe in that?
Yeah, I really do believe in that, and I will do that in my own life.
Okay, I will ask you a question, Sister Zainab.
Yes, but you know, Sister Bita, you're talking about something that might be a little bit dangerous. You know,
exactly.
There are some experiences that you want to touch and you want to go and just taste whatever they, however they are.
Jessa, I will give you an example. See, there is a fire. And your child would love to throw herself or himself into that fire. Would I, as a mother, let them get into it? Would I let them get burned?
Just no, at all. But here I'm at age that I can think, you know. I can just verify whether this way is good or not. And sometimes I want to experience it, you know, at every cost. You cannot limit me. I bet it.
And unfortunately, Bita, as one of the youth who is present at the society, at the modern society, we cannot just ignore her ideas.
Of course.
You know, Asma, I have a little boy.
Yeah.
And when I see him doing dangerous things, I try my best not to keep him from doing that in case it is not dangerous. But if it is dangerous, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he screams, or no matter how much it makes him angry, I would keep him from doing that, Bita.
I know that. I know what
keep
you
that
mean.
In mind.
But I want to tell you that this control that you are, you know, actually committing on your boy somehow is limited, you know. It comes, for example, to age of 18, to age of 20 or something, and you cannot control her or him anymore.
You know, the dangers are quite the same, as you see. You know, touching something dangerous, something like a knife.
Metaphorically, they're the same.
Going out with
the
person called X, who is not a good person. You know, I cannot say that your parents are supposed to keep you and take you and, you know, confine you in home.
Yeah.
However, but what I believe is that your parents are supposed to control you and keep you from doing very dangerous things. However, they must respect you, Bita.
Yeah.
As a young girl, they are supposed to respect you and just have control over your conducts from distance.
Yeah. So I guess the situation is getting so interesting as we go further. We're having quite a debate in here. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you for staying tuned. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Back to Reality. We're talking about conflicting reality, which is the debate between parents and the children, which is actually a never-ending one. Because as long as you're a child and as long as some people who are your parents are in love with you in a way that they would never want you to get any harm, then the debate will be ongoing forever. Now, we had plenty much of ideas in here. Bita actually is going with the young generation more and more.
She's on the side.
Yeah, on the side of the young generation and on the side of the children. She says that parents should not limit their children and it's a sort of controlling their children, which is not true. And we also do not recommend it because controlling is not what we mean. When we say the parents should take care of their children, we do not mean that something happens miraculously on the spot. What I prefer is that to nurture your child in a way that would get to the amount of maturity that would decide by themselves and take the best decisions ever.
I do agree actually with you in this perspective. But when you control or you try to control your children because you know something is dangerous, the young generation will act in two ways. First of all, there is a group like me who will fight against you, who will tell you frankly that no, I want to do that. Yeah, exactly. No, I'm not that much rebellious or something. No, at all. But there are another group in my generation that will tell you that, okay, of course, you're correct. I will do that. Okay, my dear mom. And then go out of the home, I don't know, go to school, go to society, and she or he will act like another person. I think this is the bad part of the story.
So you mean they cannot stand in their parents' face, but they can do it in society?
Exactly.
So they would turn into rebellious people in society. Mm-hmm. Now I agree with that.
So
half of the truth is just like this.
Exactly. So I'm going to tell my dear sister Zainab that if you want your children to be safe in the society, you cannot just limit them or control them. You have to teach them, you know, to protect themselves.
Exactly, yes, that was what I wanted to say, that the way the parents behave is of so much importance. You know, we do not put the burden on the children because, you know, they have no enough experience in their lives.
Yeah,
the
and parents they're very much eager to have experience.
Yes, and it is the parents who at least claim to be experienced. So they are supposed to know how to treat the child. Teenager would do whatever she or he likes to do, whether she or he fights her parents or just pretends to be an obedient child.
Yeah.
So it is the responsibility of the parents to do the good type of, you know, teaching to make them aware of the dangers, to befriend, you know, Asma, what is really important and what I see that is the major root of the conflicts between parents and children is the lack of friendship between these two generations.
Yeah.
You know, the parents try to be those controlling the child,
yeah,
and they, as the traditional point of view suggests, mm-hmm, them, they expect the child to surrender completely to his or her parents.
Yeah.
We all have heard of parents who say that when we were young children, we did not dare to disagree with our parents.
Yeah.
We were so obedient children. Mm-hmm. We were such and
the
such.
Same old story.
Exactly.
Yes, and they expect their children to act just like the way they were as children. But the difference is that a modern child is quite different from those living in the past.
Yeah.
You know, a modern child is more energetic. He or she has lots of energies while being confined within the walls of the apartment they are living in. So the child is not that active child of that time. You know, modern childs are more smart. They are more clever. And they are impatient.
Mm-hmm.
So
I would say that they have more of means, you know, to engage themselves with. I would call it this way, you know. Let's just not say that the other generations were not smart or they were not clever. No, it's not just like that. I would say that recent generations, they have more facilities. They're more equipped to do the things they wish to do.
Yes.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be back after no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
There was a time I used to think that it is very much true that parents should make a friendly relationship with their children. But then as I grow older, I understand, and I just consider all the families, I would see that Yes, friendship is very good with your children, but you should have this idea in your brain that do not get too close because the authority of a parent should stay in their place.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And also from another perspective, this story of friendship with your parents is somehow bothering for our generation too. You know what? Because when it comes too close to your limitations, to your actual comfort zone,
yeah.
It's like they are actually disturbing your privacy somehow, and it's not something we like to,
yeah.
You know what? And I don't like it that much when it comes to a way that they will, you know, for example, as a friend, they will decide everything for you. And this is not true.
Yeah, that is very much true. I would agree with that. Well, we know that the story of the long debate between parents and children is not going to end in only 14 minutes. It is less of a time to finish it. But you can read the entire story yourself. There is too much of things to say from both sides, from the sides of parents, from the sides of children. What matters is that the parents should act like mediators, so that they know their children. Then